You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate today. Pesticides like weed killers, insecticides, and fungicides increase crop yield by killing pests, but they're also a known health hazard. Susan Frankel and Lee Fong, both contributors to The Nation, have investigated how pesticides affect farm workers and the current policies surrounding their use. Susan Frankel's article, Warning Signs, How Pesticides Harm the Young Brain, and Lee Fong's article, The Pesticide Industry Versus Consumers, Not a Fair Fight, both appear in the March 31st edition of The Nation magazine. Welcome to both of you to The Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks for having
us.
So why don't you walk me through the history of pesticides a little bit? It seems like we've been living with pesticides forever, but when were they first invented, and what were the very first pesticides that were used?
Well, gosh, I mean, going back to the, I don't know a lot about the history, but going back to the early 20th century, you had, you know, some really, really pretty noxious products out there, you know, that were sort of outright poisons that were used for pesticides. But the industry really got going sort of mid-20th century, and that's like since 1945, our use and reliance on pesticides has really taken off. It's quintupled. And the ones that we talked about, organophosphates, that was a class of chemicals that were originally developed actually as nerve agents during World War II. And people realized that they were so effective at kind of turning off the nervous system of insects that they began adopting them for use in agriculture. And organophosphate, the ones that we looked at, actually started to be used after World War II, but then really took off in the 60s when people were looking for replacements for DDT, which, as you might recall, was the pesticide that Rachel Carson found to be so hazardous in Silent Spring.
Silent Spring, right. So that's a little troubling to know that the history of these pesticides started with nerve agents. That's kind of concerning. But what are the most common pesticides now that we see being used in farms?
Well, the top 10 pesticides, and you know, I can say these names. I don't know how much they'll mean to people. They were sort of gobbledygook to me. The big one, the most commonly used one, is glyphosate, which is also called Roundup Ready, and it's a weed killer
That's like Roundup that you get at your hardware store?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same Roundup you get at your hardware store, used in, you know, the millions and millions of pounds in farms across the country. Atrazine is another one. It's a pesticide that there's a lot of controversy about because there are some scientists who have shown that it does stuff like cause changing sexes in frogs and hermaphroditic frogs. There are fumigants like methylbromide and chlorpicrin, which are also commonly used.
Wait, you left me. I'm still stuck on the changing sexes in frogs. How does that how does that work? There's a chemical that can change a frog's sex.
It has the property of disrupting hormones, which actually is something that's coming out about a lot of chemicals in use. I mean, it's what people are so upset about, say, with bisphenol A, that plastic component. I don't know a lot about atrazine, but I know that they've had some studies showing that it affects sexual development in frogs.
Mm-hmm. So
these are pretty powerful agents.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the bottom line.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and we're just learning a lot about pesticides today and what they do to us specifically. I'm talking to Susan Frankel and Lee Fong, both contributors to The Nation, who have written articles on this topic in the March 31st edition of the magazine. And Lee, hang in there, because I'm going to get to you in a moment, but I'm still getting over this shock about the frog thing, and I'm going to ask Susan some more questions. Susan, what difference do these chemicals make for the output of crops? Is it just a huge difference in yield?
It's a big difference in yield. And, you know, in the story that I wrote, I talked to growers in the Salinas Valley, which is, you know, this incredibly rich, bountiful valley in Central California that pretty much most of the lettuce people eat around the country comes from. And, you know, for them, they say that without pesticides, they just could not produce the volume of produce that we rely on. It's certainly not at the kind of, you know, with the sort of economics that they now enjoy. And, you know, they argue that it would be really hard to switch to organics, you know, if for no other reason than trying to find enough, you know, manure to cover all the acreage in the Salinas Valley. You know, and as consumers, I mean, we like to go into the store and have our apples and peaches and, you know, grapes look really good and blemish-free. And people, growers rely on pesticides to give us that kind of really pretty produce as well.
Well, speaking of pretty produce, going to the grocery store, what are the types of fruits and vegetables we'd find at our grocery store that are most likely full of these pesticides? And then what are the least likely?
Apples are probably the top ones. Those get those are sort of the top of the list of sprayed produce. There's every year the Environmental Working Group puts out a list they call the Dirty Dozen that of the most highly sprayed fruits and vegetables. And so apples, strawberries, grapes, celery, peaches, spinach, bell peppers, nectarines, cucumbers, potatoes, cherry tomatoes, and hot peppers are the top Dirty Dozen for 2013. The ones that have the least residue would be things like corn, onion, pineapples, avocados, cabbage, sweet peas, papayas, mangoes, asparagus. I just happen to have this list in front of me. Eggplant, kiwi, grapefruit, cantaloupe, sweet potatoes, and mushrooms.
This actually sounds like a helpful list. Where could our listeners find this list if they wanted
it? The Environmental Working Group, EWGG.org, puts it out every year. And they actually put out little cards that you can take with you to the grocery store to help you remember.
Okay, good. Now, your article follows a study called, is it pronounced Chamacos? Is that how it's pronounced?
Chamacos.
I got that totally wrong. Well, it was a good try. It's an acronym, though. So
right.
What is Chamacos and what does it stand for?
Well, the acronym stands for the Center for Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas. And what it is a long-running study where a group of Berkeley-based researchers started following a group of migrant workers, mainly migrant workers in the Salinas Valley. And they tested the women for levels of pesticides while they were pregnant, and then they began following the children that were born to those women, and they've been following them for about 15 years now. And basically what they found, and I think the reason the study has gotten so much attention, is that they found that children who were prenatally exposed to the highest levels of pesticides showed signs of neurodevelopmental problems over time. They were more likely to have things like learning problems, ADD, poor reflexes, and at 7, when the kids were tested for IQ, they showed slightly lower IQs than the kids who had not had as high a prenatal exposure.
Mm-hmm. And how big a sample size was this study? Do you happen to know?
The original study was about 560. Mm-hmm. Families, and then some of the families dropped out, and they added more. But it's, you know, several hundred kids.
Mm-hmm. And what inspired the study? What kicked this off? Was there already some anecdotal concerns about these children, or?
No, the woman Brenda Eskenazi, who's the lead researcher, is a neuropsychologist who's been interested in sort of chemical effects on brain development for a while. And in California, agriculture is, you know, one of the biggest industries and one of the major places that people are exposed to chemicals. So she got this grant, a federal grant, and decided to focus it on pesticides. And in the Salinas Valley, at the time, the most widely used pesticides was this class of pesticides, organophosphates.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, a similar study was done in New York following a very different population, kids who were living in low-income housing who had been exposed because landlords spray for cockroaches, also with organophosphates. And there, what prompted this study was that the researchers discovered that there was detectable levels of these pesticides in about 70% of the women in the late 90s. And they thought, that's a lot. We better look at what's happening to the kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, you you wrote about a woman, Maria, who's worked in the California Valley harvesting fruit and performing other jobs as a farm worker for 23 years. What is her experience?
Well, she moved to the Valley with her parents who were looking for work, and she and her husband are both farm workers. She worked in the fields, and she got involved with the study. And what was really surprising is she knew she was being exposed to pesticides. She never really thought a lot about it and certainly didn't think about what it might mean for her children. And as it turned out, her daughter, as a baby, began to develop really, really severe asthma. I mean, asthma that kept her out of school many days at a time. Her next born, a son, also had asthma, though not as bad, but he, had a lot of sort of behavior problems and ended up being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and with Asperger's. And then her third child, who's only about a year and a half now, doesn't seem to have any problems. But when she got involved in the study, she discovered that there are links between those problems, asthma, ADD, behavior issues, Asperger's, and pesticide exposure. Now, she doesn't know because nobody does a sort of one-to-one connection and the research doesn't show, strict cause and effect. She can't say, I know that what I was exposed to caused these problems, but, it's a disturbing set of associations.
Let me ask you a very basic question about how these farm workers come into contact with pesticides. Is it that the crops are sprayed and then they're in the course of picking the fruit or touching the fruit? Is it a tactile thing where that's how it's transmitted to them? And then how does it get transmitted from them to their homes and their families?
It's a tactile thing. They're picking crops that have been sprayed, and theoretically, they don't go into the fields immediately after being sprayed. There's various kinds of sort of buffer times that are designed to be protective. But so they pick, say they pick a strawberry that's been sprayed. They're putting it into crates. It's getting on their fingers if they're not wearing gloves. Even if they're wearing gloves, it's getting on their clothes. Actually, if you drive through the Valley, you see people just swaddled in clothes, long sleeves, long pants, shirts wrapped around their faces and their heads. But whatever has been sprayed on those crops is getting onto their clothes. It's getting on their skin. And if they're not careful, they're bringing it back into their homes because they're coming in, and unless they're taking off their shoes and sort of stripping down before they go in the house and showering before they start hugging their kids, all of that stuff is coming into their house. And this study, Chamacos, has done a series of studies, really showing clearly how what's in the fields gets tracked into people's homes. In addition, a lot of these folks are living right a stone's throw from the fields that
sure.
are being sprayed.
I'm speaking with Susan Frankel, and I'm about to be speaking with Lee Fong, who's been very patiently waiting as we've been having this conversation. They're both contributors to The Nation. We're talking about the health impact of pesticides. Susan's article, Warning Signs, How Pesticides Harm the Young Brain, and Lee's article, The Pesticide Industry Versus Consumers, Not a Fair Fight, appear in the March 31st issue of the magazine. And we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. Well, you may be wondering what exactly is sprayed on the fruits and vegetables you find at your local grocery store. Is this stuff safe to eat? And my guests today have a lot to say on that topic. They are Susan Frankel and Lee Fong, both of The Nation magazine, and they have written articles on the topic of pesticides in the March 31st edition of the magazine. So, Lee Fong, I want to get to you at long last. We're talking about how the pesticides come into contact with the workers. You write about spray drift. What is that exactly?
Well, as Susan was explaining, when these chemicals, these pesticides, are used in an agricultural context, in many cases, the wind will take the pesticides and bring them into adjacent communities. So you have towns, small cities near these agricultural sites that are being affected by the chemicals that are being used. So these pesticides, whether it's chlorpyrifos or others, are being brought through the wind into homes, into schools, even into hospitals, just via the weather. This is a serious issue because these pesticides are coming into contact with children who are more vulnerable to the negative health risks.
So people are living in kind of a fool's paradise if they think, well, this is a migrant worker, you know, a farm worker's problem, because it can affect communities of people who are not working in the fields at all. It's being sort of blown their way.
Sure. In the Salinas Valley, many of these communities are populated by farm workers, but of course there are other people who live there as well, and of course their children who might be born into these families, but and although they're not working in the fields, they're still affected by this type of chemical spray drift.
Now, you just mentioned a chemical called, is it chlorpyrifos? That's how it's
yes.
pronounced. What is the origin of that?
Like some of the pesticides that Susan was talking about, chlorpyrifos is a cousin to the nerve agents that were stockpiled during World War II. It's used as a pesticide to kill worms and other insects, and it's been very controversial. It's been studied over the last 50 years. It's been found to be very dangerous to infants. Infants that come in contact with this chemical have significantly higher rates of neurological disorders, problems with utero development, brain impairments, low birth weights, hormonal disruption. So chlorpyrifos was actually banned for household use in 2000 because the chemical not only has been used in an agricultural context, but since 1965, Dow Chemical, the main manufacturer of the chemical here in the United States, has marketed chlorpyrifos as an insecticide for home use to kill cockroaches, what have you. After kind of a long laundry list of studies showing the many hazards of chlorpyrifos, it was finally banned in household use, although it is still widely used in agriculture.
Does that strike you as a little bit strange? I mean, we're saying you can't use it around your house, but it's okay to use it in the fields in growing crops that are going to then wind up in our house? It seems like we're not really covering all the bases here.
No, and I think for advocates, for scientists, for folks who have been really studying this issue for many years, they're very alarmed at the lack of action from regulatory agencies, because there's been a push to remove chlorpyrifos from agricultural use for a very long time, but there's been no action taken.
Now, we got a call from Richard from Hollis, Queens, raised a very good question. He says, do the pesticides on the fruit and vegetables stay on the surface, or do the chemicals enter the meat of the produce? In other words, if you bring home this stuff and you wash it off, is that not really doing any good, or does that help?
For chlorpyrifos, from what I understand, it can be largely washed off. So it's more of a risk to farm workers and to communities in those areas. But for other pesticides and herbicides, I'm not sure. My article mostly concerned chlorpyrifos.
Mm-hmm. Susan, in your article, you include a statement from Environmental Protection Agency spokesperson named Kathy Milbourne, that the current threshold of exposure to pesticides is, in her words, protective of all ages, including babies. That doesn't sound consistent with what I'm hearing you guys say.
I think a lot of people would take issue with it. She was talking specifically about chlorpyrifos, but I think a lot of people feel the EPA is not doing the best job at protecting children. They are supposed to build safety margins into the exposure that children get. And I think a lot of environmental advocates and scientists would say that those safety margins are not always adequate, particularly because one of the things the Chimaco study has shown is that some kids are genetically more susceptible to the effects of organophosphate pesticides than others. And so a margin that might work for the average group of kids might not be protective for those particularly vulnerable kids.
Do we know what makes some kids more genetically vulnerable than others?
It's a genetic mutation in this one particular gene that governs how the body detoxifies.
This gene you talk about is the gene PON1. Is that the gene you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And it makes some children as well as adults more or less susceptible to the effects of organophosphates.
This is an interesting question. I find this kind of shocking, but a caller named Deborah from Newark, New Jersey, was at a school where pesticides were sprayed during school hours. Is that in concordance with the law? Can you do that?
I don't exactly know what the laws are. Some of them vary state to state. But I will tell you that the pesticide that Lee was talking about, chlorpyrifos, which has really been pretty well documented to have adverse effects on kids, it's one of the top 10 pesticides used near schools in California, which mm-hmm. I found really shocking.
Lee, on this topic of chlorpyrifos, tell me about California's Proposition 65.
Prop 65 is a state law here that prohibits businesses from discharging substances known to cause birth defects and reproductive harm into drinking water. Also, it requires that places where a certain chemical is used to have warning signs. Well, advocates, including the Pesticide Action Network and others, have lobbied over the years to have chlorpyrifos listed as a hazard under the Prop 65 law. And they've pushed and pushed and haven't been able to obtain that listing. My article actually opens with a little bit of an anecdote of a meeting at an office called the California Office of Health Hazard Assessment, which is the regulatory body that makes these types of decisions for which chemicals are listed under Prop 65. And it just kind of shows that, in this particular meeting in 2007, you had a small group of farm workers, advocates, scientists who have been very critical of chlorpyrifos, and then a small group of scientists working for Dow Chemical, the manufacturer of chlorpyrifos. And according to people who were at this meeting, the advocates received only a few minutes to speak, and they were kind of shut down. And the regulators then turned to Dow Chemical, and each were given 5 to 10 minutes to speak. And there was quite an imbalance there. At the end of the day, the regulators decided not to list chlorpyrifos under Prop 65. And this kind of imbalance in time is kind of indicative of the larger political dynamics in the state, where Dow Chemical, in many states, has been able to just circumvent the kind of opposition. They've been able to wine and dine legislators. They've been able to help elect politicians. They've been able to kind of set the information that's just out there in the public just by spending lots of money on advertising and on internet advocacy. So for Prop 65, although the studies would suggest that chlorpyrifos deserves to be listed under the state law, it still has not been.
So as far as Prop 65 is concerned, chlorpyrifos is considered safe?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I want to get back to this in a moment. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm discussing the problem of pesticides and the effect of some still very widely used pesticides on our health and our children's health. I'm talking to Susan Frankel and Lee Fong, both of The Nation magazine. They've both written on this topic in the March 31st issue of The Nation. So it's obvious where Dow Chemical gets its money because it's a huge, huge corporation. It's made a lot of chemicals that have been used in war as well. So it's a big, it has been a big defense company. So they've got a big war chest. Where do the anti-pesticide researchers and activists get their financial support?
For groups like Pesticide Action Network, they're largely reliant on donations. So certain foundations have given the money, but largely, I believe, it's regular consumers, activists, chipping in tax-deductible money to the group. So they're kind of reliant on just the charitable giving of others. So, of course, they've got a much smaller budget, and those budgets kind of range from year to year based on the charity of others.
Let me ask you, Lee, what criteria do pesticides need to satisfy before they can go on the market?
This is another point of contention. There are a number of laws that advocates say need to be changed. The Toxic Substances Control Act, which governs chemical safety in this country, hasn't been updated since the 1970s. Mm. And that law actually grandfathered in 60,000 chemicals that still have not undergone any type of environmental or human safety testing. Although they're used regularly. I mean, this is Congress.
This is 60,000 chemicals that have not been tested?
That's right.
Okay.
And this issue has been kind of a back burner for Congress, although it gained a little bit of momentum after the chemical spill in West Virginia in the Elk River, because MCHM, the chemical that was the licorice-smelling chemical that was spilled into the creek there that got into the drinking water, that's one of the 60,000 that has not been tested. The firm that manufactures that chemical, Eastman Kodak, Eastman Chemical Company, they actually had studies on their own product, but they consider them proprietary. So regulators, members of the press, they had basically begged the company for information about this chemical that was affecting everyone's drinking water. So many chemicals that have been used in prior use before the 1970s that got grandfathered in still have not been tested.
This is a question for both of you, so Susan, you can weigh in on this. Don't products have to be proven to be hazardous before they can be pulled off the market? In other words, you've got these 60,000 products that are being used regularly, and does something bad have to happen to somebody before it gets one of these 60,000 gets pulled off the market?
Well, that's the problem, is that it's not. I mean, the laws governing chemicals in this country tend to take more of a, you have to actually prove that it's, not that you have to prove that it's safe, but you have to prove hazard. And that's
so we have an innocent until proven guilty system
exactly,
for our chemicals
exactly.
as well.
Exactly. Pesticides are a little more tightly regulated than mm-hmm. the stuff under TSCA, but it's still it's very, very hard to show dangers. I mean, the Chamaco study has been going for 15 years. It's cost about $10 million, and that's a study focusing on one class and a handful of chemicals of pesticides within that class. There are, thousands of chemicals registered as pesticides, and to do these kinds of studies on a chemical-by-chemical basis to laboriously demonstrate what are difficult to tease out risks has been very tough. And, I will give the EPA, benefit here that it's a tough job that they have to do, but the laws don't make it very easy for them to sort of stay on top of the science and pull a product when there are, signs of danger.
In the EU, doesn't it work exactly the opposite way, that chemicals have to be proven safe before they're allowed to be sold? They try to prove that
essentially,
there's...
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, so we're doing it exactly
the
opposite
They have the precautionary
way.
Principle.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome to the United States. I want to get back to Lee on this because you raised some somewhat sobering David and Goliath case of Citizens versus Dow Chemical and Activist versus Dow Chemical. Is there anything, so we don't end on a note of total despair, is there anything that somebody who's concerned about this can do, or are we watching just a very sort of grim situation here?
Well, on the spray drift rules, after long being lobbied by advocates, the EPA in January opened a rule for comment that would allow regulators to go in and start testing and measuring the health risks with this pesticide spray drift from farms into local communities. Now, this regulation is still in its comment period, meaning that anyone can go onto, I think, regulation.gov or the EPA website and submit their own comments to regulators. That's an opportunity to get public input into the process and to ask for a tougher rule. And it's important that the public and folks who are impacted by spray drift weigh in on these types of regulations because, you know, as we speak, industry, Dow Chemical, their lobbyists, their trade associations, including a group, very large group called Crop Life America, which represents basically all of the large pesticide makers, they're furiously working to influence this rule. They're working with their congressional allies to push back on this rule. They've put websites up to get folks to weigh in on their behalf. So it's important that members of the public and folks who are concerned about this weigh in with their own concerns. So that's an opportunity if folks want to go online and submit their own comments. Regulators, by law, have to take a look at all of these comments and at least read them and in some cases use them for consideration. So that's an opportunity. That's something that's going on right now.
Okay. Well, that's something that our listeners can do if they are so motivated to do so. I've been speaking with Susan Frankel and Lee Fong. They're both contributors to The Nation. We've been talking about the health impact of pesticides. Susan's article, Warning Signs, How Pesticides Harm the Young Brain, and Lee's article, The Pesticide Industry Versus Consumers, Not a Fair Fight, appear in the March 31 issue of the magazine. Susan, Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.